Welcome to the Malefactors Register podcast. In this edition we present a pair of tragic tales of murderous Arizona families. The first tells the story of two brothers who mistakenly thought they had planned the perfect armored truck robbery. The second highlights the tale of three brothers who helped their father break out from prison only to end up in a bloody cross-country chase.
Wasted efforts. If Mike and Patrick Poland had put as much effort into working as they did into preparing to commit the perfect robbery, they wouldn't have had to resort to crime to survive. Instead, they figured it was simpler to take the easy way out, and as a result a couple of security guards ended up dead and the Polands ended up with needles in their arms. Mike had a run of bad luck that extended back as far as he could remember. He had never been much of a worker and had little history of continuous employment. In the summer of 1976, however, he had hopes. He was expecting to win a personal injury lawsuit that would have taken his family back from the brink of bankruptcy, and then things were going to change. Unfortunately, he lost the case, and as a result he and his family had to give up their property in Oregon and head back to Arizona where his family lived. He was borrowing money from everyone just to keep his head above water. Mike Poland and his family lived first with his brother Pat, then with his father, George, and finally ended up in their own apartment. They were maxing out his father's credit cards to buy gas and clothes and were dodging calls from collectors who were trying to get them to pay past due medical bills. For his part, things weren't going much better for Pat. He was borrowing money from his father, his younger brother, and a friend. Together, the brothers had run up a $15,000 debt to their father alone. Something had to change. The Poland brothers put together a plan to bring in some tax-free income by posing as Arizona Highway Patrol troopers and robbing drug dealers. They also apparently supplemented their income by selling raw turquoise to jewelers. Around Christmas, they bought a pair of Chevy Malibu sedans, one silver and one white, the vehicles and color schemes used by the Arizona Highway Patrol. Each of the cars was equipped with a siren activated by a toggle switch on the dashboard. Pat ordered a radio scan, which allowed them to listen in on police frequencies. In February 1977, a man using the name Mark Harris ordered a taser from a Tucson gun shop. Harris came in and made a deposit for the taser. A few days later the taser arrived from the manufacturer and Harris picked it up in the company of another man. The sales clerk identified the two men, Harris and his accomplice, as Pat and Mike Poland. While continuing to hold up drug dealers and make ends meet by selling turquoise, the brothers made preparations for their big score. Someone named Mark Harris ordered three distinctive canvas bags from a Phoenix manufacturer, placing a special order for bags made to his specifications. At the same time, Harris ordered 100 feet of green and white cord known as Rover Rope. At that time, the company which sold Harris the rope was the exclusive dealer for Rover Rope in Arizona. The evidence shows that a month later, in May 1977, the brothers took further steps in preparation for their crimes. Mike and Pat purchased a light bar similar to the ones that police cars and public safety vehicles use. The brother told the vendor that they were planning to start a towing company. The invoice for the light bar was made out to Harper's Towing, but the salesman and a company receptionist, who met the brothers on several occasions, swore that the Poland brothers were the purchasers of the light bar. Also in May, Mike contacted a buddy who had once been a cop and asked if he still had a Sam Brown belt, equipment used by police to hold handcuffs and other gadgets. Although the friend no longer had his belt, he referred Mike to a couple of law enforcement supply stores where anyone could get such a belt. Several weeks earlier, on Tuesday, May 10, 1977, a person identifying himself as Mike Poland made a collect call from a payphone on State Highway 17 near Black Canyon, an area north of Phoenix but before the Bumblebee turnoff. The call was placed to Mike's residence. That location was significant because the payphones in that area at the time provided a clear view of the northbound lanes of Highway 17. The time is equally important because the call was placed at an hour when a perforated armored van filled with cash passed through Black Canyon on its regular Tuesday delivery route. 2 weeks later, around 9 o'clock on May 24th, a husband and wife were headed north from Phoenix on Highway 17. As they approached the Bumblebee turnoff, they spotted a white car stopped just before the exit. One man was inside the car behind the wheel, while another, in a tan uniform, was outside with one foot on the rear bumper. These witnesses testified that the lookout appeared nervous. The wife was able to identify this man as Mike Poland. There was more than enough reason for Mike to be nervous that morning. The perolator van filled with cash destined for several banks in northern Arizona was more than an hour behind schedule because of mechanical trouble experienced before leaving the perolator facility. Eventually the truck did leave, headed for its first delivery at a bank in Prescott. A second couple following the same route between 9:30 and 10 a.m. recalled seeing a perolator van stop by the side of the road 10 yards or so from the highway. A man who appeared to be wearing the uniform of the Arizona Highway Patrol was standing near the door of the van on the driver's side. The witnesses reported that the passenger's door was open as well. They both identified the man they thought was a trooper as Pat Poland. As further evidence that the stop was not an official one, Arizona Highway Patrol reported that it had no troopers in the vicinity of the Bumblebee turnoff at that time. The armored car never made it to Prescott. Police would find it a day later, abandoned and empty, with the two driver guards missing. While the police were processing the van on the morning of May 25th, the Poland brothers were 300 miles away at Lake Mead, the body of water created by Hoover Dam, which is an easy car ride south from Las Vegas. The brothers got to Lake Mead by borrowing their father's pickup truck. They also took a tarp he always kept with the truck. The brothers arrived at Temple Bar, at the time one of the few developed areas on the Arizona shore of the lake, in the early morning hours of May 25th. Pat dropped Mike off at Temple Bar and continued on to an even more remote area called Bonelli Landing. At Temple Bar, Mike rented a boat, telling the owner he was planning to meet someone at Bonelli Landing, a 16-mile trip by boat. The Temple Bar landing manager thought it was strange that Mike had no fishing gear. Around 2 p.m. on the 25th, Mike returned with a companion. The manager could not identify the companion as Pat, but it seems likely that it was him. Mike reported that their pickup truck was stuck at Bonelli Landing and that they needed a tow. Eventually, a tow truck was found, and the two brothers and the driver headed out to Bonelli. There, they found the truck backed about 10 feet into the water. The tailgate was down and the water was approaching the gate. The tow truck driver would later testify that it appeared that something had been dragged out of the bed of the truck into the water. The brothers blamed drunken foolishness for getting the truck stuck. Mike paid for the $93 tow with a new $100 bill and told the driver to keep the change. On Thursday, May 26, the brothers returned the truck to their father, complete with a new tarp. The old tarp, they explained, had been ruined when they tried to get the truck unstuck from some sand. Decomposing bodies float unless proper steps are taken to allow the gases that build up inside the corpse to escape. Criminals almost always underestimate the amount of buoyancy a dead body has or the amount of effort and weight needed to keep a corpse underwater once it starts to decay. Such was the case with the Poland brothers and their murder victims. On June 16, 1977, a boater found the body of one of the perolator guards floating near Bonelli Landing. The upper part of the body was encased in a canvas bag, which pinned the guard's arms to his sides. Police divers found two pieces of wood tied together with green and white cord subsequently identified as rover rope. The rope was tracked to the salt distributor in Phoenix and from there the cord led the authorities to the Poland brothers. A week later the second guard's body was discovered in the same part of Lake Mead. The next day, June 24, 1977, divers found more of the canvas bags and rover rope. On July 27, 1977, FBI agents executed search warrants of Mike's house in Prescott, Arizona. They found $13,000 in currency, including $1,000 in $100 bills, several rolls of coins and a radio scanner set to police frequencies. Authorities also found several handguns, rifles and shotguns, handcuffs and a blackjack. At Pat's house, searchers found more than $15,000 in cash hidden in a bag. Back at Lake Mead, The divers also found the TARP, a fake Arizona Highway Patrol license plate and two handguns in a canvas bag weighted with rocks. Forensic accountants looking into the spending habits of Pat and Mike found that soon after the robbery they paid off several debts and were generally living large. From May 24th to July 27th, 1977, the brothers spent around $83,000. When they were questioned about where the money came from, the brothers admitted that they were robbing drug dealers, but denied having anything to do with the Peralta robbery. After a five-week trial with 153 witnesses, the brothers were convicted of the crimes of robbery and murder and sentenced to death. In 1999, Michael Poland was executed by lethal injection. His attorneys presented evidence that he was incompetent at the time of his death. The stress of being on death row had taken its toll, psychiatrists said. When asked if he had any final words, Mike replied that he was hungry. "I'd like to know if you're going to bring me lunch afterward," he said. "I'm really hungry. I can't think of anything else." Patrick Poland was executed in 2000. Anything for Dad. The three Tyson brothers, Donnie, Ricky, and Ray, were brought up to respect their father even though he was never around. It wasn't like Gary Tyson had abandoned his family, everyone knew where he was. Gary was serving two consecutive life terms in the Arizona State Penitentiary for killing a prison guard during an escape attempt. Even though Gary was a career criminal who spent most of his adult life behind bars, he commanded the love and respect of his three boys and his wife Dorothy, whom he had met while he was serving time for armed robbery and auto theft. He was apparently quite the charmer, people around Casa Grande, Arizona said, which was why Dorothy was more than willing to stand by her man while he marked time in an Arizona prison and why his sons would one day risk everything to break him out. Dorothy and Gary married in 1957 and a year later Dorothy presented Gary with his first son, Donald. Richard and Raymond followed soon after. With the family to support, Gary tried to stay on the straight and narrow, but it wasn't really in his nature. In 1961 he was arrested for a series of robberies, this time he was handed a 30-year stretch. But Gary's charm worked its wonders and after serving just 5 years of that sentence, he was granted parole on July 1, 1966. Freedom would last less than a year. In April 1967 Gary was arrested for smuggling and ordered back to prison on a parole violation. Gary had always been a rabbit. Before his first felony arrest in 1951 he led police on a high-speed chase and before his trial on the 1961 robberies he managed to escape for a day from the county lockup. Heading back to prison as a parole violator, Gary knew this would be his best chance to bolt for a long time. A mile away from the prison Gary managed to grab the pistol of corrections officer Jim Stinner. He shot Stinner in the chest, killing him. Gary made his getaway in the prison car, but was arrested a day later in a Casa Grande movie theater after a wild shootout. For that murder Gary received two consecutive life sentences. Dorothy remained loyal to her husband and taught her sons to respect their father, somehow convincing the boys that the murder was a setup. They visited the prison almost weekly while growing up and developed the view that poor Gary Tyson was simply a misunderstood victim of the system. With nothing but time on his hands, Gary waited until the moment was right to make his move. After nearly a decade behind bars for the Stinner murder, Gary, a violent killer with multiple escape attempts, was elevated to trustee status and was put into a cell with another trustee, Randy Greenewald, who was serving a life term for the murder of a truck driver near Winslow, Arizona in 1974. In that killing Greenewald drew an X on the window of the sleeping trucker's cab and fired through it. He was also suspected of at least two other killings in the Southwest. Sometime in 1977 Gary decided the time had come to make his escape. Through family, he tried to enlist the help of a pilot who would pick him up and take him to Mexico, but that plan went nowhere. Gary turned to his family. In late July 1978, Gary enlisted the help of Raymond, who along with Dorothy, began to amass a cache of weapons for the breakout. The day before the escape, Ray and Gary brought Donnie and Rick in on the plan. Ray would later claim that they had been assured there would be no violence. "I just think you should know when we first came into this we had an agreement with my dad that nobody would get hurt because we wanted no one hurt," he told police. Some supporters of the family say this demonstrates just how well Gary had brainwashed his sons, because they should have known not to trust the word of a man serving a pair of life sentences for killing a prison guard during an escape. They were 18 and 19 years old at the time with no criminal record. James Clark, a University of Arizona professor, told the Arizona Republic in a 2003 retrospective on the Tyson prison break. Clark wrote the book Last Rampage, The Escape of Gary Tyson. "Gary Tyson conned these boys like he did everyone else. They were surprised as much as the victims at what happened." July 30, 1978 was a typical hot, dry Florence, Arizona, summer day. It was visiting day at the Arizona State Prison, and like they had done so many times before, the Tyson boys showed up early to spend the day with their father. While Ray went on ahead, Donnie and Rick carried in an ice chest. The CO at the gate was distracted for a moment, and when he looked back at the boys to prepare to search the chest, he found himself staring at the barrel of a sawed-off shotgun. Gary and Randy Green AWOL grabbed a couple of more weapons from the ice chest and quickly rounded up everyone in the visiting area. They locked the guards, other prisoners, and their visitors in a supply closet and were gone from the prison grounds in a matter of minutes. The escapees left in a green Ford sedan, which they ditched about a mile away from the prison in favor of the white Lincoln Continental provided by one of Gary's relatives that was left in the parking lot of a nearby hospital. They headed toward a remote safe house to lie low for a while. Their luck began to run out in the form of a badly leaking tire, which they exchanged for the spare. News of the Tyson prison break spread quickly, but corrections department officials attempted to calm jittery nerves by reminding people that the men, though they were convicted killers, were model prisoners. One group that was paying no attention to the news was Marine Sergeant John Lyons, 24, his 24-year-old wife, Donalda, their 2-year-old son Christopher, and 15-year-old niece, Teresa. The family was driving from Yuma to Omaha, where John was planning to attend law school once his service with the Corps was finished. Terry Jo, who lived with her family in Las Vegas, was enjoying a summer vacation trip with her aunt and uncle. She brought her pet Chihuahua along for the ride in the Lions' Mazda. On July 31, the two groups were converging on Flagstaff when fate brought them together and their blood began to flow. The back roads of Arizona had taken their toll on the Lincoln, and in the desert near Quartzsite another tire failed. This time there was no spare. The group decided to flag down a passing motorist and steal a car. Raymond stood out in front of the Lincoln, the other four armed themselves and lay in wait by the side of the road. One car passed by without stopping, but then an orange Mazda driven by John Lyons drove by, made a U-turn, and stopped to render aid. In the moonlight, John stood by Raymond and examined the blown tire when he felt the shotgun poke him in the back. Suddenly the family was surrounded by five armed and desperate men. The Lyons family was forced into the back seat of the Lincoln. Ray and Donnie drove the Lincoln down a dirt road off the highway and then down a gas line service road farther into the desert. Gary, Ricky, and Randy followed in the Lions' Mazda. They parked the two cars trunk to trunk, and the Lions family was ordered to stand in front of the Lincoln's headlights while the Tyson gang transferred their belongings from the Lincoln into the Mazda. While the others guarded the Lions and Teresa, Gary fired his shotgun into the radiator, presumably to completely disable the vehicle. The hostages were then escorted to the Lincoln and again ordered to stand in its headlights. Ricky Tyson told authorities later that John Lyons pleaded, "Jesus, don't kill me." and that Gary said he was thinking about it. John asked the Tyson's gang to give us some water, just leave us out here, and you all go home. For a moment it looked like Gary was going to agree, and he told his three sons to go back to the Mazda for a container to hold some water. Raymond later explained that his father was like in conflict with himself. What it was, I think it was the baby being there and all this, and he wasn't sure about what to do. Then Gary appeared to make up his mind. Ricky said that the brothers returned from the Mazda and gave the water jug to Gary, who then, with Randy, went behind the Lincoln. They spoke briefly, then raised the shotguns and started blasting. 16 shots were fired. John Lyons managed to stagger some distance from the Lincoln before collapsing. Teresa made it far enough that it took searchers several more days to find her body. The Chihuahua was found next to her, dead from exposure. Knowing that she was fated to die, Teresa took the dog's collar and fastened it around her ankle so whoever found her would be able to identify her remains. Leaving the Lyons family to their fate, the Tyson gang headed toward Flagstaff, where Greenewalt had a friend. Kathleen M. Entraught was contacted by Donald Tyson on the afternoon of the day following the Lyons murders. She later met Greenewalt at her home about 9 p.m., and there was a discussion about their use of her son's truck. On August 3, Greenewalt returned with Donnie and told M. Entraught to go to town and buy them a vehicle. She left Greenewalt at the house to watch her grandchildren. Meanwhile, Detective Bill Prebill of the Coconino County Sheriff's Department arrived to interview M. Entraught, who had been on Greenewalt's prison visitation list. The plainclothes detective knocked on the front door of the Flagstaff area mobile home but received no answer. After looking around a bit, he left. Prebill did not know it, but Greenewalt was hiding inside the mobile home armed with a sawed-off shotgun. Greenewalt said he mistook Prebill for a salesman. It was Prebill's lucky day. If I had known that expletive was a cop, I'd have blown his expletive head off, Greenewalt told investigators later. M. Entraught and Donnie returned later with a blue four-wheel drive Chevy pickup. A day after the Tysons left M. Entraught's trailer and several hundred miles east in Amarillo, Texas, James and Marge N. Judge were just starting their honeymoon. They were headed to Colorado for a week of fly fishing. Marge N. checked in with her parents from the road and reported all was well. That was the last time anyone heard from the newlyweds. Shortly after the phone call, the judges encountered Greenewalt and the Tysons, who needed their van and were willing to kill to get it. James and Marge N.'s honeymoon ended in a shallow grave outside Pagosa Springs, Colorado. With the law hot on their heels, the gang turned back south toward the Mexican border. Around the same time, a game warden came across the Lyons crime scene. Donna Lyons and her son Christopher were inside the Lincoln. John Lyons' body was a short distance away. Teresa was nowhere to be found, and at first authorities suspected that she was a hostage. At the time of the breakout, this story had a lot of Wild West elements in it. The Tyson family was not unlike the Clantons in Tombstone, Professor Clark told the Republic. But they became monsters in public perception after the bodies of the baby and teenage girl were found. The Tysons drove back toward Casa Grande in Pinal County, where the law was waiting for them. Driving the judge's van, they plowed through a roadblock on the Papago Indian Reservation, exchanging shots with the police. Donnie Tyson was shot to death when the stolen van smashed through a police roadblock, failed to negotiate a curve, crashed and burst into flames. Ricky, Ray, and Randy Greenewalt made it to a nearby field before being captured. None of them was injured. Officers said the van contained four pistols, two sawed-off shotguns and a rifle. Gary Tyson got away. For 11 days he was still at large in the desert, and considered the most wanted criminal in America. His body was eventually found about a mile from the roadblock. Gary had burrowed into a thicket and had died of starvation and exposure. Greenewalt and the surviving Tyson brothers were all convicted of the Lyons murders and sentenced to death. Eventually, after a long legal debate over whether the sons could be executed even though they had not pulled the trigger or agreed that the hostages would be killed, the state of Arizona re-sentenced them to life in prison. Ricky expressed remorse for the Lyons murders soon after he was captured. "It took us by surprise as much as it took the victims by surprise because we were not expecting this to happen. And I feel bad about it happening," he said. "I wish we could have done something to stop it, but by the time it happened it was too late to stop it. And it's just something we are going to live with the rest of our lives. It will always be there." Greenewalt was executed in 1997.
We hope you have enjoyed this edition of the Malefactors Register podcast. These true crime stories were written by Mark Gribben and read by Peter Gray. This episode was produced by Jeffrey Barnes and certain musical selections were composed by Justin Ard Urban. I'm Rachel Johnson. For more true crime stories on the web, visit markgribben.com. This podcast is copyright 2011 and may not be rebroadcast without permission of the copyright holder. Until next time. Goodbye.